From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And Robin, you and I haven't been on the air together yet this week. So I want to start just by asking you, as I've been asking everybody that I've talked to, how are you doing?
Well, it's good to hear your voice and the small, noble crew. I'm looking at all of them at Here and Now in the studio. We're doing fine. Are you wearing your PJs? How are you at home?
I'm wearing clothes. I'm broadcasting from home today. I've been saying I'm doing good just reflexively, but I guess none of us really are doing good right now. But we are getting through it. Some big headlines in the world of coronavirus today. Global death toll now more than 10,000 people. 245,000 confirmed cases across the globe, and the U.S. border with Canada is going to close just before midnight to all non-essential travel.
And Jeremy, we know that Italy passed China, Italy having the most reported deaths. China, for the second day in a row, has reported no new cases. And New York Governor Andrew Cuomo followed California in telling all non-essential workers in New York State to stay home.
And the IRS deadline for filing taxes has been pushed back for everybody to July 15th. We're joined now by Republican Senator Rick Scott of Florida, who is in self-quarantine himself after being in the same room as a press secretary for Brazil's president who tested positive for COVID-19. Senator, welcome, and how are you doing? Are you feeling okay?
I'm feeling fine. I've never taken my temperature this many times. I'm generally at 97.5. I've never even hit 98.6. But I'm spending my time, I'm talking to mayors and police chiefs and sheriffs and hospitals and doctors, and get lots of ideas from people about, you know, how we can beat the coronavirus and how we can keep our economy going.
What do you think of what California's Governor Gavin Newsom just did in California, issuing a statewide stay-at-home order? And do you think Florida should do the same?
Well, what I've been clear is one, federally, we need to close our borders. We've got to stop the risk of people coming in with coronavirus. You know, of course, if you're a citizen and permanent resident, you can come. The next thing we've got to do is we've got to do what South Korea and Taiwan did. They create a robust testing system. So we've got to really push to get these testing sites up in every county, in every state in this country. And then we've got to streamline the process, and we've got to all understand we're in this together. So we have to self-quarantine.
Well, on the issue of testing, and you're right, South Korea has had a lot of success in dealing with coronavirus because of aggressive testing. Why hasn't the U.S. Been doing that at the same pace? We've known about the coronavirus for just as long as South Korea has.
Well, I've been talking about it for quite a while. In Florida, there's some places that are having a hard time getting swabs. Some places don't have enough test kits. So I think one thing about America is our healthcare system, it's a local delivery system. That's not a federal response. You've got to get everybody to coordinate their efforts. And then the federal response, they can help pay for things, and they can help make sure the supplies are there. So everybody's got to continue to figure out how to work together better and better every day.
What about Florida? You say that maybe it's not time, or maybe it is time to do what California has done. You're not going to take a position on that at this moment, but what have you thought when you've seen these images that have been circulating all over social media about people partying on the beach in Miami and other places in Florida and don't seem to worry about the risks of doing that?
Well, it's first off, it's irresponsible. It's stupid. It's selfish. We all have to understand that we've got to make sure we're not somebody that infects somebody else. And I love the beach like all of us do, but we can't all be in there as a group. You know, like I live in Naples, Florida. The county commission shut down the beach. You know, I think that was the right thing to do. But the other side, Jeremy, you see people doing the right things. You see the people that are going out and harvesting food. You see the truck drivers getting groceries to the store. You see both sides, and you see all these people going to work at the hospitals, making sure they have everything. So there's some people you're very disappointed in, and there's people you're just thankful for.
Senator, I have to ask you about the news involving your colleagues. Republican Senator Richard Burr, according to ProPublica, sold off a lot of stock last month before the markets tanked and after he wrote a Fox News piece saying the U.S. was better prepared than ever for the virus. There are also reports that Republican Kelly Loeffler sold seven figures worth of stock after attending a Senate briefing on coronavirus. Should these senators resign?
Well, I mean, I don't know all the details, but I think all of us, I mean, if you run for office, you're expected, you know, to have pretty high standards. So you can't use your office or a crisis for your own personal benefit. So I think everybody ought to be focused on how we solve the problem. And that's why I've been very clear what I think what we ought to do, but a decision about what they're going to do with their positions. In America, we have elections, and so people will be held accountable for the decisions they make.
Have you sold any stock after being briefed on the virus?
No.
I've been very, let me find,
you know, I've yeah, go ahead. Been very concerned about this thing for quite a while, Jeremy. As you know, if you follow, I've been talking about this virus since it first started coming out and trying to do everything I could to try to push people to get prepared.
Let me finally ask you, Senator, what you think of the bill that was unveiled by Mitch McConnell, the majority leader, that would send money to Americans. It could be worth more than $1 trillion. It also includes $50 billion for airlines. How do you feel about that bill at this moment?
Well, I want the main focus on the main problem. The main problem is the coronavirus. I also want everybody to understand that when we spend somebody's money, it is somebody's money. It is a taxpayer's dollars. So what I want to do is spend the money to where we help the people that are hurt. The hourly workers that just lost their job or their hours went down. The small businesses that are getting hurt. I'm not interested in big business bailouts. I'm interested in helping the people that got hurt. Now, I think the way to do it is I've got one, you should use the existing unemployment system. You should also, if you want to get money to people quickly, you do like a 60-day moratorium on their rent, their mortgages. Then you don't have to go through some government bureaucracy that's going to get something out. What you do is you immediately give people some cash flow to help them through this crisis.
That is Senator Rick Scott, a Republican of Florida, in self-quarantine right now. Senator, we hope you continue to feel well, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, to the UK now, where thousands of retired doctors and nurses are being asked to return to help fight the COVID-19 outbreak. Britain, Scotland, Northern Ireland together have more than 3,000 cases and 140 deaths. And a report from Imperial College warned it could get much worse. Let's bring in BBC political correspondent Rob Watson. Rob, the initial government response there was criticized as too tepid. That's changed.
And this is what changed, I think, is when the scientists and Imperial College is working, if you like, as part of the government effort, when they did the modelling, relying in large part on the figures, the latest figures coming in from Italy, the country in Europe worst affected, that they realised, they thought that just if you tried to slow the transmission by minimising a bit social contact, that wouldn't be enough. I mean, that would lead potentially to about 250,000 deaths in the UK. And in order to get it down to something that they thought was more, I don't know what the right word is here, Robin, acceptable, manageable, but that in order to get it down to, say, 20,000 deaths a year, that they would have to go for the sort of tighter restrictions that we're now living under.
Well, and we now know that one of the authors, the researchers behind that report, Neil Ferguson, says he has symptoms of COVID-19. He's put himself in self-isolation. So a couple shocks there maybe for the people in the UK. But what else is happening? Schools closed, bars and restaurants closed?
So the big things that have happened is that you can only go to work if you really have to. Avoid anything but essential travel, social distancing, so stop going to pubs, restaurants, and absolutely, it seemed to me that the last vestige of normal life in this country went when the schools closed, or that was announced that it'll be happening. But here's the thing, I've seen pictures of life in Madrid and in Rome and in Paris where there's a forced lockdown where they're just astonishing the way the streets are deserted. I mean, it's not like that here. The government has urged people not to go to the pub, but people still have. People have gone to the restaurants. And I was out shopping. It almost looked like business as usual, apart from one thing, and that is people stripping the supermarket shelves.
Yeah. Are there people calling for a lockdown or a shelter-in-place order?
Yes, there are. I mean, I think there are some scientists, there are some medics, there are some people working inside the National Health Service, Britain's socialized system of medicine, saying, come on, if we really don't force people to abide by these rules, then the health system is going to be completely overwhelmed. And again, it's important, I think, to go back to what the sort of central government policy is. It's basically about a trade-off. It's saying, look, you know, we can either have very large numbers of people dying and our economies keep going, or we try and stop our health systems being overwhelmed. We try to stop the elderly and the vulnerable dying, but that is going to cause a massive economic dislocation.
Yeah. Look, I'm wondering if people are, you know, sitting upright at some of these numbers. Just briefly ask you as we close here, So, as I said, there have been 140 deaths, terrible, in the UK. But that's an area of something like 65 million people. In the US, there have been 60 more deaths, at 200. But we have 350 million people here. It feels as if there have been a lot of deaths in the UK.
Well, there are two ways of looking at it. I mean, I guess there are some people in the UK who just think, what is all the fuss about? And there are others who will say, no, you just don't get it. Look at what's happening in Italy. Look at the potential for the numbers of deaths if we don't actually do anything. Look at the potential for our healthcare system being overwhelmed. And if anything, we're not reacting enough. So if you like, you have that sort of split in this country, as of course you get in other countries, those thinking it's an overreaction, and others thinking this is nuts. The evidence suggests we should be doing even more.
BBC political correspondent Rob Watson, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/here now. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply. Offer valid through March 31st, 2020.
A prominent member of Congress is under scrutiny today for selling substantial amounts of stock shortly before markets turned sharply lower. Senate Intelligence Committee Chair Richard Burr sold his stock after receiving classified information about the coronavirus and warning well-connected constituents about it while publicly downplaying the virus as a public health threat. Joining us now is NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales. Claudia, today Senator Burr asked the Senate Ethics Committee to investigate his stock trades. What is he saying about these accusations?
Well, he's saying that he learned information just like the rest of the general public, and that is what drove this decision to dump all this stock. However, there are obvious concerns there, as the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, that he would have access to additional information compared to the general public. That said, I think this is the senator's effort to try and get somewhat ahead of this and make sure that this is investigated, there is a report, and that the general public can get a better sense of what went behind this decision.
Well, because even people like the Fox News host Tucker Carlson came out and said, if this is true, if this is what he did and acted on this information and selling these stocks, he should resign. What kind of trouble could this cause a senator of his stature?
That remains to be seen, but it is pretty surprising to see some of these folks raising concerns. I saw a message sent out by Senator Tom Tillis this morning of North Carolina saying that Senator Burr owed, and this is a Republican, this is a fellow Republican, saying that Senator Burr owed North Carolina's an explanation and wanted to understand what was behind this decision. So whether this has some sort of permanent damage, some sort of major effect for Senator Burr, that remains to be seen, but definitely there's a lot of heat on him right now.
Claudia, we're also watching the action in the U.S. Senate. It does look like Republicans are not all on board with Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's plan to give many, but not all, Americans direct checks of up to $1,200 as a stimulus. What's the hangup?
So there were initial concerns. We did hear about that in terms of handing out these payments. However, we have heard more Republicans, at least publicly, sign on to the idea. They might be differing in terms of how much the payments are, to who, at what stage, and what level of income. But they seem to be coalescing a little bit more, we're seeing, in terms of saying, let's look at these payments. The effort that the Republicans are pushing does include some bailout measures, and that is where the big gulf comes in between Democrats and Republicans. Democrats presented their own proposal last week, and they want to focus on the workers. So there's quite a gap for them to close. They're on those negotiations now, and so we'll see where they land in the coming days.
Well, and we heard Senator Rick Scott, Republican of Florida, just minutes ago say that he has some concerns, reservations about handing out hundreds of billions of dollars in loans for big industries. Is that going to have a problem getting passed?
Yeah, so that's going to be another tough detail, because the way they approach these negotiations, what's interesting this time, this is the third wave of incentives that they're looking at in response to the coronavirus illness. The first couple of times, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi took the lead, but this time, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell did. His plan was, let's negotiate this among Republicans with the White House, and then we'll start negotiating with Democrats. And so there's still a few snags here and there, as we heard with Senator Scott, that they're not 100% on board. However, they had this similar issue with the second wave of incentives that were just passed earlier this week. And McConnell told the members that his party that they needed to gag and vote for it. So perhaps there'll be some more gagging and voting for it when this bill
goes on. That is NPR's Claudia Grisales. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Well, earlier this week, Peru, which draws thousands of visitors to Machu Picchu, issued a 15-day nationwide state of emergency, closing all borders and grounding all flights. And now hundreds of Americans are stranded there. They're stranded around the world as well. But Julie Givens is stranded in Peru. She's a teacher at Berwick Academy in Maine, stuck in a hotel room in Cusco with her husband and three kids. Julie, what have you heard from U.S. authorities on what to do?
The only communication that we've gotten from the embassy is to try to get out, which we can't, and to prepare to be here indefinitely and find lodging. We had already done that by the time we got that communication from them, but it's really been pretty limited.
Yeah, here's the security alert that the U.S. Embassy posted on Monday. American citizens not able to reschedule their flights out of Peru should arrange lodging for the duration of the quarantine period. Luckily, you could do that. But also tweeted the same day, the welfare and safety of U.S. citizens is our top priority. On Tuesday, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said the State Department has a responsibility to try and help American citizens wherever they are. Do you think there should be more help, or do you think, you know what, maybe I just try to wait out the quarantine?
I think that if we had certainty that this was a two-week quarantine, we would be happy to wait this out. Given what's happening both at home and in other countries, there's just no certainty for that.
Right, especially with kids there. Having been to Machu Picchu, I know, you know, the draw there. But did you, you know, consider maybe not making this trip because of what's been brewing since January?
We did. And honestly, there were no travel restrictions in place when we left. And my concern was, what if one of us gets a cold while we're away? And coming back into the U.S. is problematic because we sort of show symptoms even though we may not have coronavirus. But what if we just have, you know, a cold or something and we get quarantined at home or get stopped at the border? And there was nothing that anyone indicated, our government or the Peruvian government, that it would have been risky.
In fact, I think when you went to Peru, our president was saying this is going to just pass through, and there wasn't any sense of urgency.
No, and we never would have brought ourselves or our children anywhere where we thought they would be unsafe. And in fact, the reason that we're in Cusco right now and not in Lima is that we made very sort of well thought out specific choices to not try and do something drastic. We know of people who drove to the Bolivian border on Monday and tried to cross over before midnight. We know of people who've driven to Lima, and it took 30 hours over the Andes in sleet and snow. And some of the, you know, information out there that, well, you know, people who are stuck abroad, it's their own fault for traveling. They should have known. That's hindsight. Nobody thought it was unsafe to come here on March 8th when we left.
Well, now you're part of a Facebook group called Americans Stuck in Peru. More than 1,000 members. Does that help that you're not the only one?
Yes. It's a real emotional roller coaster, but the Facebook group has been really helpful. It's good to know we're not alone.
That's Julie Givens, trapped with her husband and three children in Peru, border closings there because of the COVID-19 travel restrictions. Julie, best of luck to you. We'll stay in touch.
Thank you very much. Take care.
Well, here at home, the CDC is recommending people limit gatherings to 10 people or less, but imagine that at a funeral or a big wake. We have a story coming up about that poor family in New Jersey. Four members dead, everyone else in quarantine, no funerals. And how do you handle the body of someone who's died of COVID-19? Charlie Yoder is president of the Iowa Funeral Directors Association and co-owner of the Yoder Powell Funeral Home in Kelowna, Iowa. Charlie, have you already seen change?
Yes, we have. In particular, I met with a family yesterday, and an elderly lady that passed away. We're going to have a visitation for immediate family only. They're going to come in groups of five or six at a time, and they're going to schedule that themselves. And they're going to spend as much time as they want, and then the next group will come in. You know, it's my belief that they still need the opportunity to be able to say goodbye to mom, grandma, brother, sister. So that's what we're going to do. And then later on, we're going to have a public visitation and a memorial service to celebrate their mom's life.
That's what we hear is happening across the country at Arlington National Cemetery. Dozens of funerals have been postponed in the past, just the past week. So there's that. But then there's also how you as a funeral director interact with people and have to ask people to interact. I'm sure you want to shake people's hands. People want to hug. They can't do that.
Absolutely. I have found myself sticking out my hand. It's really hard not to have that physical contact.
Right. Are you thinking of going more online? We understand that websites like econdolence.com, shiva.com, these are funeral-related websites, live streaming websites like One Room, this is an international company, they live stream funerals. They say their 100,000 weekly views have spiked about 60%. Are you seeing people go online?
Absolutely. And this family that I had met with yesterday, they have chosen to use Zoom. I didn't know anything about it. So they're educating me. They're setting it up just for their family members that can't make the trip to Iowa.
Yeah. And then there's the other very tender topic. We understand that health officials are telling funeral directors and people who run morgues to place masks over the mouths and noses of the deceased because you can the body, even though the soul has passed, the body can exhale the virus.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. And the National Funeral Directors Association put on a webinar the other day talking about how to handle the body, and I think funeral directors all over the nation are prepared. We're here for families.
Well, and I hope we don't have to face what they are facing in other countries. We understand in Italy, well, we saw the pictures. Funerals are outlawed, and bodies are piling up at morgues. I'm sure. I mean, a funeral is such an important time. I'm sure that's something nobody wants.
Exactly. Yeah, I've seen those same pictures, and it's heart-wrenching not being able to say goodbye. What a terrible thing.
Well, again, Charlie Yoder, president of the Iowa Funeral Directors Association, but also co-owner of the Yoder Powell Funeral Home in Kelowna, Iowa. The other thing is that, you know, you are essential, you know, so you're still doing your good work. Thanks so much.
Yeah, you're very welcome. It's a privilege and an honor to be here to serve families.
And many industries we know are struggling during this coronavirus outbreak. But at least one type of business is in high demand, professional cleaning, work that can be unpleasant in normal times, but now may feel downright unnerving in the midst of this pandemic. And as Callum Borgers from member station WBUR reports, there may not be enough trained workers to do it.
Anna Rodriguez has 11 kids to support, and she needs a job with flexible hours. So last year, she started a commercial and residential cleaning company called Sparkling Star Cleaners in Rockland, Massachusetts. Besides making her own schedule, she likes that she didn't need special training to go into business.
No, you know, as a mother, I already know, like, what kind of safety for me to use, and then I did my own training online, watching videos.
Rodriguez's kind of self-taught cleaning is pretty typical, but Patty Ollinger says it may not be sufficient to confront the coronavirus. She's executive director of the Global Biorisk Advisory Council, part of a major sanitation trade group in Illinois.
One of the things that this pandemic is showing us is that we don't have enough trained individuals. This is potentially a gap in our industry from a standpoint of really making that connection of cleaning to health.
Ollinger says properly sanitizing buildings can involve experienced professionals and electrostatic sprayers, which sound like this.
You just want to keep moving, you know?
At a school in Wellesley, Mass., Tony Vasliadis is disinfecting a drinking fountain with a misting gun. It's attached by a hose to a tank on his back, and the whole contraption makes him look a bit like a Ghostbuster. Instead of trying to ward off some phantom, he and his fellow custodians are guarding against the coronavirus, an urgent and potentially risky task after the parent of two students in the district tested positive.
If I get it, I get it. I'm going to go to the doctor and see what they can do.
Vasiliadis says custodians frequently get sick in their first year of scrubbing germs and wiping up bodily fluids, some reward for a gig that starts at less than $20 an hour in this town. He says he'll even spray his car keys at the end of his shift and hope he's built up a strong immune system over 8 years on the job. The custodians take other measures, too.
Our custodians always wear gloves, and they'll wear a mask.
Joe McDonough is the facility's director for the town of Wellesley. He says there's a lot more to cleaning thoroughly and safely than just grabbing a mop and broom.
We spend 2 days training them on bloodborne pathogen, asbestos awareness, the right to know law.
That's the right to know about potential hazards, like the coronavirus, in the workplace. Simply knowing about a risk isn't the same as knowing how to minimize it. This is why Patty Ollinger's BioRisk Group is developing a new certification program that she hopes will become industry standard. She pictures plaques on the walls of hotels, for example, signaling that housekeepers use best practices to stop diseases from spreading. That could be reassuring for guests and housekeepers alike. Right now, hotels are making good faith, but largely informal efforts to protect employees, says Carlos Aramayo. He's secretary treasurer of Unite Here Local 26, a union representing thousands of hospitality workers in Greater Boston.
You know, some properties are starting to give people 5-minute breaks every hour to wash their hands, doing some trainings on how to wash your hands. I know that's a specific thing that's come up as well.
Other hotels have gone so far as closing temporarily, including a Marriott in Boston that hosted a meeting tied to the majority of coronavirus cases in Massachusetts. Marriott says it's responding to the outbreak with the help of a professional cleaning firm from Minnesota. For NPR News, I'm Callum Borchers in Boston.
The coronavirus is affecting just about every aspect of life, including the SAT and ACT. The college placement exams have been canceled through May, affecting millions of students who take the tests for college applications every year. This is also usually a busy time for college-bound high school seniors, and the coronavirus outbreak, which has shut down universities and schools across the country, is making college planning in general complicated. Joining us now is Lisa Maselli, who's the director of college counseling at the University of Illinois Laboratory High School in Urbana, Illinois, my high school. Lisa, thanks for taking a few minutes for us. And first of all, how are you doing in the midst of all of this?
I'm doing okay, Jeremy. It's just changing every day, isn't it?
It is. And we brought you on to talk specifically about how this is affecting high school juniors and seniors. What would normally be going on that's not able to go on right now, in addition to the SAT and the ACT tests?
So normally, seniors would be going back to possibly admitted student visitation programs because college admissions outcomes have still been coming their way. While there are still a handful of schools that are still waiting to send out their outcomes, spring break was a very popular time for seniors to either revisit, go to a school for the first time, also for juniors to start their exploration of colleges. So I have to say the whole campus closing down and admitted student visits canceled and no ability to actually take a tour or talk with admissions directly has been a big change in this process.
So what does that mean for students? What should they do now if they weren't able to go out and check out the schools that they might be going to in the fall?
The way that you have to do deep research, Jeremy, is often beyond the campus tours. So I think I'm going back to and trying to empower these students to realize while these are challenging times, the reality is the deep research was often being asked of students even prior to this year, to be done in a more thoughtful way where they go on and they read about departments, they read about faculty backgrounds, they reach out to current students because with equity and access issues, many kids couldn't afford to go to a college visit anyway. So I'm just trying to reground them and realize that we're here to help them and that this research can still be done.
Well, and how are you able to do that? Because your school, like so many other schools, is not operating normally right now. The students are not there in the building.
Yeah. So all of our curriculum is basically through telecounseling right now. while we're in this global crisis right now, where I do believe, Jeremy, that admissions professionals are operating under compassion, common sense, flexibility, the reality is seniors are still worried about, what will my transcript look like? What if we don't return to school? Juniors are worried about, what if I can't take an SAT or ACT until I'm a senior? How will that impact my admissions timeline? So I'm trying to connect with them through Zoom, through even having seniors come on as peer counselors and kind of talk with juniors about the process, and to get uni alums who graduated from our high school to even connect with our current seniors to help them understand how we can still kind of serve them and counsel them and mentor them even virtually.
Well, what does it mean for students that the SAT and ACT test-taking sessions have been postponed?
You know, the testing process is probably one of the biggest part that is causing anxiety for kids, because they've been prepping. They've been hearing from older students to get these exams out of the way so that senior year can be reserved for applying and writing essays. So because they've been hearing literally all junior year, study, prep, do what you can to get these tests off your plate so that you enter into your summer and your senior year with testing behind you. And because now that's being taken away from them, we're going to have to basically counsel them about how they need to breathe, realize that this is a process that even College Board and ACT is thoughtfully addressing. They're talking about adding extra summer dates. There are colleges, Jeremy, that are talking about possibly becoming test optional, because there's over 800 colleges right now that are already test optional. So I think we have some interesting conversations that are happening from enrollment managers, because the reality is this is all about caring for students and for helping them reduce some of these uncertainties.
Now, another piece of this is the financial picture. A lot of students and their families at this point in the process, depending on how old they are trying to figure out how they're going to be able to afford to go to college. Does the coronavirus outbreak affect things like college financial aid?
Yes, yes, because there are going to be new financial realities that are going to come to families. Mm-hmm. So already, just this weekend, I was being proactive in writing emails to my seniors, and already I had four or five emails within 1 hour coming back and saying, okay, you're helping us navigate this. What about if we commit to a college? Because right now, Jeremy, there is a May 1 reply date expected that seniors do make their choice. There are lots of colleges that are moving that. There are colleges that have already moved it to June 1st. But I do think, because there's that expectation of seniors realizing my decision has to be made, financial aid letters may be given to me based on a financial picture that I gave them from taxes that now might look different because of this outbreak, and who knows what happens with the stock market. I think there's going to be a huge wave of families needing to call financial aid, appealing their package, trying to figure out the college that they did choose, whether it's May 1 or June 1 deadline, is actually affordable when it comes to August.
Lisa, do you think that this situation, which we don't know how long it will last, will have a lasting impact on kids' college plans?
No. I think what we're going to have to do is help students realize that everyone in this puzzle is really thinking about how to help this system. The testing agencies are going to help figure out a way to do this. Even right now, Jeremy, AP exams are happening every year in the month of May. They're talking about, can AP exams potentially be taken at home and administered to kids online? So there is so much that is literally changing daily. And there are people committed to, how can we all approach this and be nimble and flexible and creative? So I think that the colleges right now, everything is in flux. Every hour, there is something new that is coming out to us as counselors.
Let me just finally ask you, Lisa, as a counselor, we'll take the college part out of it. How are students handling this? I think back to my freshman year of college is when 9/11 happened. Of course, that has shaped our lives for ever since, basically. How do you think students are handling just the stress of this very uncertain and scary situation?
High school is so much about the social interaction. So I think the number one thing that counselors are concerned about is just the anxieties that come around from the social isolation, because as human beings, we want to be with each other. So the increased stressors are something that we've never had to really experience before, while it's also coupled with worrying if they have enough toilet paper and food at home, and possibly vulnerable family members or friends that they're worried about. I think because of this being a global pandemic right now, we also have kids that are thinking about their basic needs while they're also trying to think about, how do I finish up my senior year strong, get that transcript off, make a college decision, worrying if my parents' income is going to stay the same. They're worried if prom's going to happen. I've already had parents ask me, is Uni High going to cancel graduation? I mean, already people are going out to already the month of May and already mourning losing all of these milestones because they feel like senior year was that year that they were waiting for to celebrate. So that's a lot that we're going to have to help students go through. There's no declaration by our high school regarding when we're going to open and what that looks like. We are here to work together. We're here to always keep everything student-centered and just help them to manage this and somehow help them reclaim some of the joy of senior year, because even making college choices is a privilege of having multiple acceptances to consider. And how do we kind of bring them back to remembering that this whole high school process and college admissions process was a journey of them learning who they are and thinking about their future in an exciting way. And that's what I hope for my students, that I can help get them back to at least that sense of, we're in this together and we'll get through it.
That is Lisa Maselli, the Director of College Counseling at the University of Illinois Laboratory High School in Urbana, Illinois, my high school. Lisa, thanks as always.
You are welcome, Jeremy. Thanks for the time.
And earlier today, President Trump said the government will waive interest on federal student loans for at least the next 60 days and that standardized tests will not be required due to widespread school closures. We'll post some of Lisa's tips for students and families at hereandnow.org.
And we turn now gently to New Jersey, where the Fusco family has lost four members to COVID-19. 73-year-old Grace Fusco, the matriarch, died Wednesday night. Her oldest son, Carmine, preceded her in death that day. Her oldest daughter, Rita Fusco Jackson, died last Friday. A son, Vincent, died yesterday. Of Grace's 11 children, two others are in critical condition. Many of the extended family are in the hospital. There are 27 grandchildren. Everyone is in quarantine. The family was active in horse racing in New Jersey and at St. Robert Bellarmine Catholic Church in Freehold. Monsignor Sam Suriani is their pastor. And Father, I can't even imagine how your church community is reacting. We are so sorry.
Well, I appreciate the condolences. It is a nightmare for that family, for the people who know them. They're well known in the community, but there's also the underlying fear and stress of the virus.
Well, but this becomes so pointed for you all. I mean, you're in quarantine right now. Your church has been deep cleaned. And, you know, I'm thinking of the older daughter, Rita Fusco Jackson. She was heavily involved in the church. She taught, as I understand it, Sunday school, sang in the choir.
Yes, she was sang in the choir. Her last rehearsal was March 1st. So basically, the choir members who were at that choir practice have kind of self-quarantined themselves. And then she also worked in our wedding coordinator ministry, reminding the brides to breathe before they come down the aisle. And then she also was very involved in the prayer garden committee.
Well, and we understand that the epicenter of this outbreak there was a, you know, some people have been calling it a big party, but we understand from reporting that this was just their average Tuesday night dinner. This was a huge Italian family, and they had dinners, and everybody came. And that included somebody who then, it's thought, had contact with somebody who worked at a racetrack in New Jersey, who also died, was the first death in New Jersey. And so, you know, everybody at that dinner, all these family members, I mean, Are they even able to mourn their grandmother, you know, siblings? Or are they all in quarantine?
They're all in quarantine. The last time I talked to anyone in the family, I was told that they didn't even tell Grace that Rita had died.
And Grace, again, the matriarch, the grandmother.
Yes.
And Rita, her oldest daughter. Ugh.
And so family members are quarantined with the immediate family, but there is no time to come together and grieve. Of course, with the new regulations, I don't know how we'll proceed, but we're open to working with the funeral homes and the family to make this as we move forward.
Horrendous. And, you know, we know that state officials came forward and said, this is what we've been saying. You can't have these, you know, gatherings, even if it's a family dinner and happens to be a big family.
Yeah, yes, because you don't know how. I don't know if it was a family member who had contact with the gentleman from North Jersey. But it's important to realize that this was their livelihood. The Fusco family were involved in horse racing. Two grandsons stopped by the rectory months ago to get their medals blessed that they'll put on their horses while they race. So this is part of their lives.
Yeah. So now you've also got 27 people from the community who had to be tested, and they're in the hospital. People want to keep them quarantined until the test results come back. So you've got that layer on this story. You have no idea how many other people might have been infected from this wonderful family. Are you worried, too, about not being able to service your flock right now?
Well, right now, I'm very grateful to my staff because several years ago, we began to do a lot online. And so far, we've celebrated Mass 3 times on Facebook Live. So we're trying to be present to our community as much as we can.
You know, Father, when your parishioners say to you, how could God do this? You know?
God didn't do this. Hmm. I really believe that viruses and illnesses and terrible things that happen are just part of life. What our faith teaches is that no matter what happens in life, God will be with us. In the good times and in the bad times, in the happy celebrations and in the sorrowing times, the grief, God will be with us. And that's the strength that I have so that I can be with my people and be able to talk to them and to encourage them not to stop praying. And it's all right to pray with tears in your eyes.
Yeah. That's Monsignor Sam Siriani. Father, we just wish the best for the other Fusco family members who are now hospitalized. We wish you all the best. Thank you so much.
Thank you, and God bless, and please stay healthy.
You too. It's okay to pray with tears in your eyes. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.